Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. And although this time we're doing something slightly different, instead of reviewing a book that I have just finished recently, we're gonna review a book that I have read previously, but that Juliana has just finished recently. Let me put it that way. So sitting next to me on the couch here is Juliana. Say hi, Juliana.
Hello.
And so what we're going to be doing is reviewing two books actually together that make up one saga, if you will, both of these books together. So Juliana, why don't you tell us a little bit about this book, or what is the book and the author and stuff like that?
So the book is Peter F. Hamilton, Pandora Star, and not only it's one big book, no, it's two big books. It's Judas Unchained as well.
Put together into what's called the Commonwealth Saga. Now, there are lots of other books in this series which I have read that Juliana hasn't read. But it goes a bit like this. I actually have some various websites open here to make sure we got this all in control here. The Commonwealth Universe. Misspent Youth is the first book, a standalone novel telling the story of the first man to be rejuvenated. And that's a big key for a lot of these stories, that a lot of these people are rejuvenated and that they can live long, long time. So even though this book is set in, what is it, year...
2380.
The actual start of the book is quite near future, you know, and the people are going to Mars by rocket ships and stuff like that. And then it skips forward a few hundred years, but the same characters are still around, even though that the whole, all of humanity is spread out across hundreds of stars. And
it says it's several characters are like 300 years old in the Pandora Star book.
Yeah. So that's the rejuvenation technology, which is talked about in Misspent Youth. And then we have Pandora's Star, Volume 1 of the Commonwealth Saga, Judas Unchained, Number 2 of Commonwealth Saga. Then we've got the Void Trilogy, the Dreaming Void, the Temporal Void, the Evolutionary Void. And then there's another one on after that, although it doesn't actually have it here on Peter F. Hamilton's own website, but it was The Abyss Beyond Dreams, which I reviewed like 3 or 4 episodes again, which I enjoyed quite a bit. Not the best book. I do actually think these books are a lot better than that. So let's set again, this is weird because I read this book years ago when it came out, or just after it came out, I guess, because, you know, I was following Peter F. Hamilton. I really liked his Mindstar Rising books and the Confederation Universe, the Reality Dysfunction and that kind of stuff. I enjoyed all of that. So when these books came out, I pretty much read them straight away. Actually, no, I think in this case, I actually waited for Judas Unchained to come out and then read both of them at the same time. And Juliana, you just read this book. Let's just talk about, in generalities, what we liked about this book, or what things stood out, or what the story is about, or whatever you want. I'll let you take the lead on this, because you just finished this book, and it's been a while since I read it, so you've got to say what's going on here.
So first of all, I didn't read it. I listened to it as an audiobook, and coming on Audible, this also includes that it's not just in the two books. It actually came in 4 books, and each book then was put into 2 parts to download.
Yeah, this is in the German version, isn't it?
In the German audiobook. And so I got it and I thought, that's okay, it's 2 books. And then I realized, oh no, it's actually in 4 parts. Each of them consists of 2.
Yeah.
So it's just crazy.
But you've been
crazy, confused
about this before, haven't you? I remember one at the Hyperion, which I think was your first episode on this podcast with me, or your first episode on the podcast was with Hyperion. It was the same kind of thing. I was like, oh, just read the first book. Just read the first one. Don't go on to follow Hyperion. Just the first book. So you downloaded the first part of the audiobook.
Not realizing that it's actually 2 parts of the first book.
Yeah.
And
but they did the same thing on Audible with the Peter F. Hamilton's book, The Great North Road, and because that was so big. They're just like, this is 2 credits. You know, it's like a 60-hour audiobook. Just have it in 2 credits.
Yeah, it does work, but it is a bit confusing. And they gave every book a separate name.
Yes.
So it was not Pandora Star and Judas Unchained. In the middle, in between, was a part of the book that was called The Big Evil or something different.
Yeah, well, they did the same thing with the Night's Dawn trilogy. In Europe, it was published as The Reality Dysfunction, The Neutrino Alchemist, and The Naked God. But then in America, all of those books were split into 2 books each to be able to, you know, print them as smaller books.
Yeah.
I don't think it's just for some more money, but like when you actually see these massive books, you're like, oh, I'm not sure if I can do all of that book. And because it's a continuing story, it's kind of understandable that they thought, okay, let's break this up into 6 chunks rather than 3 chunks, even though it is one massive story. That was a little... And how was the German audiobook? Because we're used to... Oh, well, let me put it this way. I just listened to one of these Commonwealth... Not Commonwealth Saga. Commonwealth Universe books, which was the... what was the last? The Abyss Beyond Dreams, and it was narrated by John Lee, who we know from doing the Alistair Reynolds books and stuff like that. But how was this?
The German was pretty good. He came up with some fun voices, and it was sometimes a bit confusing because once you start listening and then maybe have a break in listening and then get back to listening, sometimes it's a bit weird to get back into it. But that has nothing so much to do with the audiobook, more just with the book itself being so complex that it is sometimes difficult to follow all the storylines and all the people that appear, and it's just very, very, very a lot to talk about. And but
not just a lot to talk about, a lot to listen to.
And I spend I think the whole last year, 2014, I kind of spend listening to that whole...
You said you started in February.
I started in February with the Pandora Star.
And you've only been listening like when you've been driving by yourself.
Exactly.
And doing some...
When I was on my own on the U-Bahn, which is the Berlin Metro, or when I was driving in the car by myself, because it was in German, so we couldn't listen together.
Yeah, and so I've already read it, because there was a few times that we were like, hey, let's get an audiobook, or let's get a book that we can listen to together. We did that with The Prefect and things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're going to go on to the next...
The
Redemption Arc. Yes. We're going to do that one on our next big trip together, or our next trips together. If we run out of podcast things that we want to listen to, we'll give that one a go. So how has the reading experience been? You've been enjoying the book overall?
Very much. I really enjoy this whole load of new technology that he has put in there. I enjoyed very much the beginning of that book. It was so good to be like so surprised once they start appearing on Mars and everything is cool. We landed on Mars.
Oh yeah, let's talk about some of these technology then. So it sets up the technology in a really cool way, and this technology is used all the way through a lot of these books, and that is the wormhole technology. But we don't know it's about wormholes. Actually, when I started reading this book, I literally had no idea at all what any of the book was going to be about. It's just like Pandora Star by Peter F. Hamilton. Like, why wouldn't I read a book by this guy? I've enjoyed all of his work so far. So I started reading it, and it's this the landing on Mars, and Wilson Keim is there, and he's landing, and he's going to be the first person on Mars, and then he steps out, and I really love this is the prologue of the book, so we're not really spoiling anything here.
No.
But we, except for the nice surprise that you had and I had, but he steps out and he actually says, and he gives the quote. I can't remember what the quote is. He gives the quote of the I'm the first person standing for Mars.
Like,
and then somebody
it's a
laughs.
A tiny step for me, and like the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then someone
laughs on the radio, and they're like, "Who's laughing?
Shut
up. You can't be laughing on the radio. You can't be laughing. This is the most important. This is one of the most important human moments of the first person stepping onto Mars." And someone's laughing like shh, like that. And then they go around, and then as they walk around, they find somebody else just on Mars who's walked
and
through
it's
a
not
wormhole.
Just somebody. It is described as if there's like a bunch of two teenage boys coming out of a wormhole, which is not, of course. But they just like Ozzy Isaacs is just a very cool character just by his look and just by his appearance as well, and by what he actually did for the Commonwealth together with Nigel Sheldon.
Yeah.
And so they both step out and say, hey, we're here the same time, but not the same time, actually.
Yeah. Well, they're a few minutes off or something like that. It's a weird thing anyway. But it's a really funny thing that humans turn up to Mars and people are already there. Not because they're already there, it's just that they wanted the biggest product launch for their wormhole technology,
and it worked.
And what I really like about this is then nobody does star travel anymore, because if you can go through a wormhole to get from one place to another place, like, why would you need to fly anywhere? Like, so nobody is actually exploring the universe from that. Like, and then of course we skip forward 380 years until like humans, and there's some really great scenes. Again, it's one of those books where like not all of the story, like I was just reading through the Wikipedia summary page and you were talking to me about, so it's like, oh, this person's obviously the Starflyer agent and this person does this, and I was like, I can't remember all of these individual people, but I do remember large swathes of the story, and I remember like lots of individual scenes, and some of them from the beginning of the book are really quite catching, that they turn up and they're like, oh, here's a new planet, let's explore this planet, what's special about this planet, oh, it looks okay, and they turn up there and it turns out this planet is actually very dangerous, and they can't, like, there's like these rabbit kind of creatures that are jumping around, it's like, why don't they ever sit still? And there's a reason why they don't ever sit still, which is quite disturbing. And there's these other things that happen, and okay, we can't go on this planet, this planet's too dangerous, okay, let's go across to this other star and see if we can see another planet over there. And they're just exploring by sitting in a control unit and sending wormholes to different star systems and different planets to try and find new places to send humans to get, you know, to colonize.
Not only that, they send actually a team of people,
yeah,
who then equalize it, or how would you say, terraform it.
Yeah.
So they put out soil and animals and other bits that makes the environment so that humans at some point can live there.
Yeah.
So there are three stages of planets as well.
Yeah.
So stage one.
Exactly. Stage three, yeah.
Yeah. So they have different planets that are habitable, or not yet, or something.
Not yet habitable.
Yeah. And yeah.
And also, I'm not sure if it's in this book or maybe the next book in the Commonwealth universe, the Dreaming Void, there's actually, then it becomes like the inner worlds, the core worlds, which have been colonized from the outside. And as the expansion, as the human expansion keeps going on, there's like the, not the outer worlds and the core worlds, but like around Earth, there's lots of like a higher technology. And as you go out, the technology gets lower and lower and lower because it just hasn't caught up yet. You know,
yeah, this is the Commonwealth, how it is organized. For example, that far away planet is differently colonized than all the other planets. I don't have all the names of all the other planets in my head.
Of course not.
Because it's quite a few. And also, character wise, I just went on that page,
the character list,
Peter F. Hamilton wikia.com or something,
yeah,
where they have a big character list, and it's huge.
Yeah, it's a big book, there's lots of stuff going on here.
But in general, I really enjoyed how many people and how many storylines there are at the same time.
Yeah.
So you always have the feeling, and it's not like they finish one story and then switch to the other. It's a bit like, I don't know, it's not like Hyperion, but it's like they all wave into each other.
Yeah, and also it's kind of like, oh, this person meets that person and then their story stops, and then a bit later you'll be like, oh, and now we're following this character that person met, and
exactly,
this person was the next door neighbor of that person who just happened to be going over here.
Sometimes he starts a storyline and you think, well, what's this has to do with the overall story?
Yeah, and then 50 pages later.
You realize, okay, this character meets this character at some point later, ages later, like maybe in the second book, but we got introduced to that person and that story in the first book.
Okay, so, more technology stuff. They have wormhole, but what's the best way to get something through a wormhole? I really love this. Trains. So they have the train tracks there, and then they have a wormhole, and there's train tracks on the other side of the wormhole, and because they can match it up perfectly, you can just load someone on a train, drive it the length of the train, and once the train has covered its own length, it's through a wormhole, and then it stops at the next station, and you're like, wow, that was really quick. It's just like, it's easier to load up pallets and containers onto trains and put them through a wormhole rather than go, okay, you walk through, and you walk through, and you walk through.
Of
and
course.
So to get from one place to the other, that you get on a train, and the train stops on Earth, and then on Mars, and then on Betelgeuse, and then on all these, well, you know, I'm just saying, like, all these different...
Betelgeuse.
I'm just saying, there's different, lots of different, this it goes over to Tatooine, and across here, back to this other place, and the planet moon of Ender. So you go to all these different places, and then you come back around. So these trains just go in a loop and just go and then stop and go and then stop. And every time that they go from station to station, they're actually going to another thing. Now, I thought that was just, oh, this is just cool technology. Turns out, massive plot point for later on. Don't want to give it too much away, but that is really cool stuff. Another thing that I thought interesting with the wormholes is that it's actually really, 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 really complicated. And you think, well, how complicated is it? It was like, well, they actually had to design a super, super intelligent, super capable computer to be able to do all the calculations and open the wormholes and position the wormholes and keep them all going in the right place and all the scheduling, and that actually becomes a kind of an artificial intelligence of its own.
Yeah, the name is sentient intelligence.
Yes.
So
the SI.
It is another character, I would
yes.
say.
So that's, again, you just think, oh, that's interesting. And then, oh, that's a big plot thing as well. And all of these different things where people go, oh, where's Ozzy? Oh, Ozzy's got his own private planet. And it's like, well, no, he doesn't.
No, no, no. He's living on an asteroid.
Yeah, but what do they... People don't know that he's got his own private asteroid. You know, it's one of these legends. And he's like, is it there? And you think, oh, this is just a legend. But what Peter F. Hamilton does really well is all these things which you just think, oh, that's kind of clever. And it all ties back in. And that's what I thought was so impressive about this story. It's a massive, sprawling story. But actually, everything is kind of important. Everything comes back around into it. You know, you think, oh, the Starflyer is over here. But there's this other story going, oh, this Starflyer, why is that? It's kind of like a distraction. Why do we talk about the Starflyer all the time? And then you're like, oh. And then there's this other stuff happening. There's this planet over here far away. And you're like, what's far away got to do with anything? And the other, oh, okay, you know, and what's this person doing over here? Like you say, all of these stories do actually revolve back round into it. The only story which I actually remember which doesn't really go into it again is Ozzy's Odyssey, let me put it that way.
Oh, it does.
It does, but there's a lot of time spent with Ozzy going along the Sylphon paths, and I'm just like, so. But what did that really achieve at the end? You know, it does.
Oh, it has. This is the very, very big ending,
yeah.
Actually, that they use the Sylphon paths to do something very important.
I know, but I'm just saying, but for the amount of time he was walking, like, that became...
And I
like,
enjoyed that story part so much.
I did, but what I'm saying, it always felt like, as I was reading the book, it always felt like the most, it always felt like the biggest distraction. It's like, yeah, they're still stuck and they're going to fall off the edge of the world and they're going to do this, and it goes on. And it's just like, this their story starts like halfway through the first book and ends like all the way through to the end. I'm just like, oh, that felt, I'm just saying, for me, it felt like the biggest slowdown. Even though I enjoyed it, it always felt like the biggest slowdown as I was going through.
Yeah. But as you said, maybe at the beginning, that this is a lot about what I thought, because I just read it recently. And I think for me, it was the other way around, because the whole politics and the whole finding out who the Starflyer agents are and stuff, this was more the distractions to the story of Ozzy and Orion, who went on that really, really, really cool trip where they walked through woods and not knowing what their next step is going to do. So they land in a freezing cold area and a really hot area, and they don't have any water anymore. And it's just so cool. And I really enjoyed that story sometimes. And it was most of the time, and it was just interrupted by boring politics again.
No, I understand that. I do. I think we were just like, I liked both sides of it. Hmm. But for me, it was like the real action for me was happening over in the Commonwealth. The real action for me was with the Primes going up against the, you know, the humans. For me, that was the main thing. And then the Sylphon Paths was like, okay, this is a fun adventure, but let's just get back to the the other aliens as well.
Well, of course, it was. It was very important with the.
You keep doing this with the microphone, and I'm just hearing it. It's going to be really loud for the people. So just keep holding. Don't stop fiddling with your hand. Just keep talking.
I'm very sorry. This is just very, very annoying for me. I'm just saying, holding the microphone and then holding it.
We just got some complaints about the sound quality from the last episode. So just try not to fiddle around with your hand too much. Anyway, carry on.
Anyway. The Sylphon Paths and the Primes. What I really enjoyed was also the attack of the Primes and the stuff about Morning Light Mountain. He's such a cool character. He's an alien, but an alien character that gets, we get to hear his thoughts. We get to explain, he himself explains what's going on and why he doesn't understand everything that humans do. And it's just a very nice way of finding out how humans work if you get this perspective of an alien that is like a hive mind,
yeah,
and is working in such a different way than humans. Like, there's no surprises with Morning Light Mountain. Everything is always makes sense for him.
Yes.
His only goal is to survive and expand.
It is one of those things where you just go, the best thing about good writing of villains is that every villain thinks they're the hero in their story. You know, nobody does anything for evil reasons. Everybody does something for a good reason. And that is what I think is the genius of Morning Light Mountain, is that as you read it, you're just going, well, yeah, of course he's going to, yeah, of course he's going to do, yeah, of course. And even when the humans turn up, you're just like, well, of course, from his point of view, he's doing the right thing. No problem at all. Anyway, this is what I just want to say here. With the first chapter from the alien's point of view was amazing. I wish I'd read this before, the Void Trilogy. And this is one of those... this is Tamahome, by the way. You always got to mention Tamahome on every podcast that you do. So anyway, so he... And I totally agree. When it comes down to writing aliens, when it comes down to science fiction, that section, when you actually go, Morning Light Mountain was a motel who was in a pond on the side of a mountain. And you just go, and this is one of those times when you're reading this and you're just going, what the hell's going on here? Mm. And this story, just this chapter just keeps going on and on and on. You're just like, this is amazing. It's telling the entire history of a civilization from
his point of view.
For me, it's one of those things where it's like watching, you know, 2001 A Space Odyssey. It starts with apes hitting things with rocks, you know, with the gorillas going, I hit things with sticks, and it's, oh no, what is it? Anyway, it's just one of those things that you just start doing that, and then it kind of keeps going on, but you get every step along the way until 2001, and all the way beyond that, until like everyone's minds are melding together, you know, and all that kind of stuff, and the motiles are doing that, you know, the world-spanning alien intelligence by the end of this. And this is all within one chapter, and you're just going, every book, like in my head, every book should start off with that. It's like, okay, we're telling a story now. Okay, to tell this story properly, we've got to go back to the birth of intelligence on Earth, tell the full story of humanity all the way up till now. This is where we are in regards to philosophy and technology and science and all these other things. And now the story can start. But this happens in the middle of a book. And you're thinking, what's this happening here? And when you get to the end of it, you're like, oh, this is the bad guy. Oh, like, you know,
not only the bad guy. This is the person or the thing that can just destroy human.
Yeah. But I'm just saying that up until that point, it's like, oh, what's Pandora's Star about? Oh, it's about
some hysterical disappearance.
There's a guy, was it Dudley Bose, who saw some stars disappear, and then he's like, oh, let's go and investigate this. Okay, let's go and investigate. And then they get there, and they're like, what's this, you know, fortress of darkness or whatever they call it? It's like, what's this kind of thing? Oh, I'm not really sure. And you're like, oh, this is interesting. It's like exploring. And then suddenly the book twists, and you're like, oh, it's alien invasion. Oh, right, you know. And it was that turn in the middle of the book which really impressed me, because I didn't see it coming. And then once it happened, you're just like, this is the most natural thing ever. And this happens a few times in other science fiction books that I'm reading. You're reading and you're going, oh, what's the book going to be about? And you get to that like quarter of the way through, and it's kind of slowly revealed, and halfway through you're like, ah, now I really know what the books are going to be about. And it's really disappointing. I remember Perdido Street Station, we were talking about that the other day, by China Miéville. We listened to a podcast about it, and they mentioned it there, and they were saying, oh, it's, you know, this place and there's a city, and all this city was really well described, and the new crop is on or whatever it's called, and it's really great. And then you go, well, what's the story about? Oh, it's about this guy who wants to have wings, and they're going to make some wings for someone. And then, oh, and then this bug. And then you suddenly, oh, it's aliens. It's a big bug hunt. And it's like, and it's really disappointing that the world was set up and the characters were set up. And you think, what's the story going to be about? Oh, it's going to be about an alien killing people and them hunting it down. And you're just like, oh, that's really disappointing after that big setup. Whereas with Pandora's Star, what I really liked about it was this big world, big characters, loads of wide cast, loads of stuff going on. And then you're like, what could possibly go wrong? Like, what could possibly be the story here? What could possibly is it be important to, like, to bring all of these different characters and all these different places and all these different storylines? What could actually bring all of these together? And you're like, oh, Morning Light Mountain. Oh, Morning Light. Yeah, no. And it really does pay off. And it is. And I think that's why that is one of my favorite passages of science fiction. It's because it just goes, right, to really explain this story, let's go back a bit. And that's why I think Pandora's Star is one of my favorite Peter F. Hamilton books. The second one, Judas and Chain, not so much, but Pandora's Star I definitely thought was quite a peak.
Yeah, but I totally understand
that section.
So in general of that book, there are two things that I was slightly disappointed about. The first thing is that when it actually reveals who built the barrier around Dyson Alpha and Dyson.
Yeah, not too many spoilers, Dyson. But go for it.
No, I'm not going to say anything. Yeah. But I was a little bit disappointed that I couldn't figure it out myself, because it wasn't there. It is not something that we like. This is not a story that is introduced before, and we can figure it.
Who encapsulated the Morning Light Mountain?
Yeah, there's no way that you can figure it out yourself. Until the point that I tell you who it is.
That's true, but I don't think that's a major part of the story.
But I really, really, really would have loved to... I was thinking the whole time, is it this alien that we met here? Or is it that alien that we met there?
Yeah, it was one of the aliens that we met.
No, we didn't meet the aliens that built. No, that is the whole point. And this is why it seemed to be for you to be like that. But the aliens that built the barrier, they are not there anymore.
Ah, okay.
And so we can't meet them.
Let me put it this way. Spoiler for Dreaming Void. They're like main characters in the Dreaming Void. Like,
yeah, but not
the void,
in Bendoristan, Judas and Chen, we don't meet them. And again, I really wanted to figure out myself, ah, I know, these aliens that we met there did it. But
yeah, well, they are mentioned, but they're not the main part of it. At least it wasn't the Silphon. I would have been really disappointed that you're like, oh, and in the end, it was the Silphon who did it. It's like, oh, they were just leading Ozzy on this big chase around. Yeah, but it wasn't them. They're
I thought they had this other alien with them, that Tucci, which I really enjoyed him because he was so colourful and amazing.
Tucci at all.
And, yeah, exactly. But
I
would have loved his species to have built the barrier.
I remember O'Reilly.
Orion.
I know, but you were saying before when you were listening to the book.
When I'm listening to the book, because I'm listening to a German audiobook, and so I'm not really sure how much they change the names and stuff, and I'm also not sure how they are spelled. So I always thought Orion wasn't O-R-I-O-N, but O with a
apostrophe.
Apostrophe, and then R-Y-A-N,
like an
Orion. Well, of course, it doesn't make sense.
Paddy O'Reilly
because he's from this planet where we're not the Scottish people.
Yes, the hippie planet.
It's the more it's what's the planet called? I can't remember the planet name now. But
Silphon planet.
No, it's the.
Okay, let's first one to look it up. Here we go.
So difficult.
I'm gonna type in, find
Ryan.
He was from Silverglade. No, Silvergald.
Silvergald, or whatever. Anyway, so, but on this other, on Farway, there's these people that all have Scottish names, which is quite funny.
Yes.
They're all called Mac.
Yeah.
And so I kind of put together in my head that the Orion would be Orion. Turns out he's Orion like the star. And what I was talking about, I forgot what it was.
I know, you were saying that there was an alien that went with those guys, and Ozzy.
Tucci.
I'm thinking Ozzy is meant to be, I think we mentioned this before, that he's the, he's like the Steve Wozniak. He's like Ozzy's Woz.
Totally, and Nigel Sheldon is Steve Jobs.
That kind of thing. And, but it's funny that, I forgot to mention this, but they, after that, our last review that we did of Ready Player One, I listened to the Incomparable review of it, and they said, oh yeah, Og is definitely meant to be Woz. Like Steve Wozniak, you know, being like the technical guy who builds something with the other person and goes away and buys all the stupid toys. And I was just like, yep, like, and this is the same kind of thing here. You've got like these two inventors, one the quirky one who kind of, I wouldn't say leaves, but goes off and does his other thing. And then the other guy who kind of stays in charge and keeps control
holds
of stuff.
It together.
Holds it together.
And the other thing that...
Bruce McFoster, Casimir McFoster.
Yeah, they're all McFosters and McSobel, whatever.
Far Away, I really liked it because there's this... this kind of spoils me for other science fiction, that they have these science fiction ideas or these ideas about science fiction which are kind of so clear that you just go, well, why isn't this always done? If you've got wormhole technology, don't put a wormhole right to the front door of the ancient, maybe dangerous spaceship that's there. Far Away isn't just Far Away. There's a wormhole to a planet, and then you've got to fly around that whole planet. Don't you have to get like a plane around that whole planet? And then when you get to the other planet, there's another wormhole on the other side of the planet that then it takes you to the Far Away planet. It's like this three journey hop, and it's to stop anything coming out of the is it the Mary Celeste, the spaceship that's crashed on Far Away?
Yeah.
It's to stop it getting back. So if anything's on there, it has to go around a world, through a gateway, across another whole world, through another gateway, and then it's back into civilization. And I'm just like, this is how it should always be done. Every time any different civilization finds any alien artifact, you need to set up this like really, really long trail. It has to be really, really difficult to get there. But often they're like, just, no, let's pick it up and put it in this bunker over here. And you're like, really?
But it turns out even in that book, it doesn't really matter how many bits in between you put.
No, but they didn't know that at the time.
Well... But
it was too late. Yes. But I'm just saying, it's like, even if it was too late, it's still really refreshing that they go, now here are our safety protocols. Here are our safety procedures. And you're like, this is what we need. This is why isn't
but
all
nobody,
safety procedures?
Nobody believed any
The people on Far Away did.
They did, but yeah. They were the only ones, and they were like all grouped like, oh, they're crazy.
Don't want to give away spoilers, but maybe they had something in it.
Everyone figures out that soon enough, you will have to be convinced.
Okay.
Anyway, the second mild thing that I really not enjoyed a lot, and I've put it down.
It's a mild thing that you really didn't enjoy.
I don't know how to say it. There's Melanie Rescorai. She, of all the characters, was my least liked character. And we spent so much time with her. We spent so much time with her as kind of being a high-end prostitute. Or not really, because she doesn't get paid. But she's using sex all the time to get something that she wants, or anyone else puts her to be the one to have sex with somebody to find something out about. And she's just having sex all the time. And it's just like, first of all, the language that Peter Hamilton is using there is not needed. There is not a need of we have to be describe how they are fucking on here and there or whatever. And it's just sometimes I think he just doesn't get enough sex that he has to put so many graphic sex scenes into his books.
It's funny. It's I kind of so was mentioning unpleasant. The same thing in the previous book as well. Like, you know, when my review of the previous book is like, sometimes you're just like, oh, do we have to have like all described and everything? And, you know, like this relationship here and it's all great sex. And over here, there's more sex.
And it's not only about that. It's also about how he's using the language in it. Like, I mean, of course, yeah, sex is yeah. Good, it's fun, but the way he's using it, it's always slightly too sexist, or I don't know, he's like
too dirty.
Yeah, the language that he's using, I just sometimes just couldn't really stand with it. It was just okay.
And it's difficult to skip forward in an audiobook.
It is, and Melanie Rescorai comes up so often, and then
but she's kind of important for the story in the end.
She is kind of important, but why the hell does she has to be the character that is just the person using sex? And it's not only that she is used, she is also using it, and it's just so.
Are there any male characters who use sex a lot?
No.
I'm getting it confused. In the Void trilogy, there are some characters more like that. But I mean, I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm just saying that I understand the problems with it and agree with them.
And so anyway, with that, there was just something in the way. I'm sorry, what is that? Too loud?
A little bit. Just I've got the headphones in and it almost deafened me. But it's okay. That's why we have ducking on this on compression. Oh, well.
Okay. So coming back to cool technology.
Okay.
There are some things that was just really cool. First of all, the memory cell inserts, which are the things that back up your life.
Yes.
They have everything there, and they are memories which you can delete or save. And when you get rejuvenated.
Yeah, you edit your memories to make more space in your brain.
You either can keep everything, or you just delete it and then you just don't remember it, and as if it has never happened. Or you just put everything back, which sometimes can...
Well, this comes into Melanie's... wasn't it her introduction is that she's... that she's been put on trial. No, her husband's been put on trial for murder, or she's been put on trial.
This is the other whole side of that book, which is the Paula Mayo detective stories, which also comes in. I really liked in the Pandora Star book very much, but then fades away in the Judas and Chain.
She's important really, in this book, and she's one of the main characters. Yeah. But yeah, like I say, she does, and this is what I don't like about Pandora Star. No, Judas and Chain so much. It becomes like, oh, and now we've just got to get into the mechanics of politics and war because the enemy is known, everything's going. Let's just
so
get through to the
politics.
End. However, if you like Paula Mayo, she is in other books, including, let me just bring this one up here, in the Commonwealth Saga, which tab it is. So you've got, she's in the Dreaming Void as well, but also she, let's find the right page here, in the short stories. Where's the short story collection? Void Trilogy, Evolution of Void Chronicles. Anyway, there's I can't find the book listed anywhere, but there's Manhattan in Reverse. That's it. And there's a short story collection called Manhattan in Reverse, and there's a standalone Paula Mayo mystery set after this book, you know, or sort of like in the times around this book, and it's just another one of her, you know, Paula Meyer goes in, tries to I think there's actually two. So she becomes a star of her own detective police procedural
kind
of book.
Yeah, that's cool. Also, like when her story is told, I really really like it that she is kind of genetically modified to be a detective, and she has issues with that.
Yeah,
and
we get from Huxley's Haven.
Yeah, and she was created in Huxley's Haven, where everyone gets to be created to do a certain job.
Yeah,
and so her job is to find the bad guys and put them into jail, and if that doesn't happen, she really gets to suffer there.
Yeah,
and I really enjoy that part of the story as well. Coming back to the memory cell inserts.
Oh yeah.
These are just really cool technologies which are very much connected with the rejuvenations. And it's so cool that some people can live several lives like that. So they are not the first lifer, how they're called.
Yeah.
That you are born and then you live your first life. You get get to three different lives, which is cool because then you don't have the feeling like, oh, if I don't get to be successful in this kind of way in my life now, it's over. It's only one life that I have there. No, you can relax and say, okay, this time I just try out this.
Yeah,
and
I'll get married over here. I'll go live on this planet.
Exactly. I relax. And then next time I just get married to somebody else and do something totally different in my life. And so I really like this whole idea of it. Anyway, I'm not so sure if it's actually a good idea.
What, to have many lives?
To have as many lives as you want.
And, I think it's good. I'd do it.
Yeah, of course, I would do it too, but there would be things that we now wouldn't know what occurs around this, what problems come up with this. And some people, it also says that some people don't really get the psychological aspect so well.
Yeah.
When they come back, like they do it to Dudley Bowes, and he's certainly not really very healthy person.
Yeah,
when they
refresh it, when they put him in a new body.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, have you finished about the mind backup? Because there's something I want to say about Dudley Bowes. But
yeah, and he doesn't know. He kind of does know what happened to him, but on the other hand, he doesn't know if he died and then, or that he died, and then he's like really giving everyone credit that they left him there, and
yeah.
He gets really
how could you leave
terrible.
Me behind? Yeah, yeah, it's he has kind of like survivor.
He's
no,
such
not survivor.
A whiny character.
Let me put it this way: there's this thing called survivor remorse, which is where you know, you're on it. It's a shipwreck, and everyone escapes, or not everyone escapes. Like 90% of the people die, but you survive. Like at the end of Titanic, there was only room on the plank for one person, or something like that. And she gets, and then she has, you know, survivor remorse. It's like, oh, there was more people. Lots of people die. I could have done more. But he has the opposite. He has not survivor remorse because he's trying to enforce survivor remorse onto all these other people because he had victim remorse, or or not victim remorse. I don't even know what the technical term for. Maybe it's mentioned in the book, but I like that exploration of that. But of course, it turns out, mild spoilers, not completely dead. And this is what I really like about Morning Light Mountain, that so many things you just go, well, this alien is completely inscrutable. Like you don't understand it. How can you understand an alien? The minds are completely different. And here it really does show, like, oh, there is a connection, you know, there is this kind of thing. So when you understand the connection between the primes and the humans and the primes, it doesn't feel too far-fetched. But it could be, you know, so often with science fiction, you think, well, how can this be compatible? You know, like, why are we even seeing in the same color with aliens? You know, like, all that kind of stuff.
But
and it's explained well in this book.
This is what is so well done in this book is when you have Tucci, for example. He doesn't speak. He speaks with ultraviolet length waves or something.
Yeah.
And so first, when Ozzy didn't have any of his electronic devices, he just couldn't communicate with him because he had this round thing where he created these waves, and at a certain point they were able to communicate.
Yeah.
Otherwise, nobody, because Tucci couldn't hear, so he couldn't hear any vibration or frequencies that Ozzy was giving to him. And so,
is this the book where they go to the High Angel and they talk to this big elephant kind of creature and talk to him and they say, "Oh,
as
this,
well,
yeah, is it?
Yeah,
is,
yeah,
is
yeah,
it?
Yeah."
And in this one, you think, "Oh, this is amazing. This guy is really great." You know, this alien, and then it slowly comes to a conclusion. Katux, and it turns out Katux
is an addict.
He's just a human brain addict, and you're like, "Oh." Oh, okay. The only aliens which can actually interact with humans or are willing to interact with humans are kind of like the lowest of the low of their society. You know, they're so far above us that it's only the dregs of their society who actually
exactly.
want to interact and help with
and
humans.
And it's not only the brains that he's interested in emotions.
Yeah,
he just wants to live through human emotions, which. Peter F. Hamilton puts there as something very special, which is true because it's not only Katux, but it is also Morning Light Mountain, who doesn't understand human emotions.
Yeah.
Which makes us so different from alien species.
But that's why it's so funny that that Morning Light Mountain's one kind of yardstick of human intellect and human emotions is Dudley Bose, because it's just a funny
yeah.
Thing like that.
Of all the humans
that could have been poked
on the Commonwealth, he got Dudley Bose.
Yeah, wait, who isn't a bad guy? But like you say, this
he's
is what,
not a very good
representation.
Example.
Yeah. Anyway, so we've gone 40 minutes on this. Let's should we
just
a few
one,
more things?
Yeah,
then?
One more thing. What I really enjoyed also is, of course, now I totally forgot what I wanted to say. Is the other thing that people have, oh yeah, the OC tattoos. So meaning that people get some sort of electronic tattoo into their underneath the skin, and they can use that for different purposes. And there's this one guy, Gore Benelli. He has so many of these tattoos and so many of these later inbuilt electronic
yeah.
stuff that his whole appearance is like a golden shimmery thing.
Yeah,
and he's
like almost a walking computer. Isn't
yeah,
he?
He's almost so much a machine himself that he's like the transition between the humans, the aliens, with this lack of emotional competence.
Yeah,
and he's like a bit this higher step up biologically. He can think quicker, he can move quicker, and he's like the link between the aliens and the human, kind
yeah,
of.
That's true.
And also, what is really cool is that the thing that the humans also have is this possibility to they have this second mind. I don't remember how that was called.
Well, it's like a little intelligence agent that they can send
the
into
transceiver,
the
transceiver. It's yeah. The implants. It's probably part of the memory cell insert. It's one of these inserts. Anyway, so they can get emails and they can get notifications and they can look.
But they
at
have to be
things.
In within range. They have to have like cell phone reception for it to work. You know, for them to
yeah,
get through to the larger
satellites
intelligence
or something that have to be there.
Yeah,
because Ozzy when he's out. On his way on this adventure trip, he doesn't have that, so he's just purely human, and all the others have these second. I don't know how to describe it, but it is this cool thing for me. I would love to have that, but on the other hand, it feels so much like that you would just. That is just too much work for your brain to do at the same time to talk and sit and talk to somebody, and at the same time you check the news.
Well, that's what I'm doing now. You're talking, and I'm actually just checking over the stuff that I'm
yeah,
wanting to see. I'm listening to you.
You're not talking to me.
Yeah. Oh, you mean so if I'm talking, but also at the same time as I'm talking, I'd be like
yeah.
now we'd be like there was a Firefox tab open here somewhere,
but not having to do that.
Yeah, at the same time.
And I think it feels a bit like you know this invention they have it in BMW cars now, the head up display.
Yeah,
and
it's like your Google Glass but built in.
Yeah, built in, but so that you have kind of have the head up display behind your eyes, kind of, and then can communicate with other things and people at the same time while being in the real world doing real stuff.
Yep.
This is just a really cool idea. But to me, it feels a bit that humans are not really suited to that. Maybe yet? I don't know.
I don't know. I think it's an interesting thing. Once you can actually format memories, you can... I can just look at you, have a conversation, and be building real short-term memories of what we're doing now. And then I can look away, and instead of me actually having to process everything in my own brain and then access the short-term memories to be able to see that, I can just have something put in, short-term memories just inserted directly into my brain. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, you don't, it doesn't have to be your intellect. You can say, you can go, what's that person's telephone number? And I can go, okay, I'll get to tell you in a second. We can start talking. And then I can, as soon as the pause comes up, I'll just remember it. And it's not because I have remembered it. It's because my brain has just put in a short-term memory of me having a going away and looking up that telephone number, coming back again. But it's just there alongside the memory of me chatting to you as well. So maybe it's that kind of thing. And I always think that's the kind of thing where you have this little transceiver and you send out an agent into the unisphere and it comes back.
Yeah.
It kind of just implants. It doesn't actually tell you the information that you have to process it. I mean, I can't remember if it's like this in this book, but this is the kind of thing that I always think about with implanted. It's like once you can implant and edit memories, you don't need to learn stuff. You can just remember stuff.
Exactly.
It's like, you know, Total Recall that we saw
before.
Yeah,
it is similar. And this is also then again, when we talk about the difference between Morning Light Mountain and the human species, is that although Morning Light Mountain is so much higher in intelligent by processing things at the same time, humans... ability in doing that is by having these inserts and transceivers, but at the same time being still an individual person. So you get the benefit of everything, of everybody, and communicating with everybody if you want to, and also being a very individual person with your own emotional decisions and stuff like that. So even if we are maybe not as intelligent as Morning Light Mountain, we have other benefits.
Yeah, we have more abilities and different access to different like strata of intelligence, different levels of intelligence, different forms of intelligence, rather than just pure processing.
Yeah. And this is what this book's make it so, as I said in the beginning, it is very complex, and not only in story and characters, but also in this whole, like how the book is called Pandora's Star. There's nothing called Pandora's Star. It's purely about the metaphysical or symbolic meaning of having
loosing intelligence into the world.
No, of
fire being revealed.
No, what is the word I'm looking for here? Of being
conscious.
Free will. If you want to know something and you look for it, and like
knowledge.
No.
A librarian.
No.
Google. I'm feeling lucky.
No, if you really want to explore something,
temptation.
No.
What? I don't even know what the concept you're saying is.
Anyway, if you
Pandora's box is it's forbidden. You're not allowed to open the box. Don't open the box.
You open it anyway. Yeah. Why? Because you are
curious.
Yes.
Curiosity killed the cat.
Curiosity. That's it. And
I'm feeling curious.
And so the human curiosity of going there.
Yeah.
And trying to find it out anyway.
Yeah. I mean, it is
the whole.
It is a kind of let's punch you in the face with the title on this one.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yes, and. Let's wrap it up there. I think we haven't gone into too much detail about this. I mean, there was lots more stuff we could have talked about it.
Because it's really difficult to not do too much spoiler.
Well, it's not just about the spoilers. I don't think we've done that many spoilers. But also, I just can't remember all that much about it. You know, but I'm not going to read it again. There's other series of books. I've just started Hydrogen Sonata by Ian M. Banks. So we're going to get back onto our culture reading series.
Yeah, finally finishing it, maybe.
We've only got two books to do. So let's see if we can do them by the end of the year. Or at least one more book before the end of December.
Yeah.
And so, what else are we going to talk about? No, I think that's it. Let's wrap it up there.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy this series? It was a long-term companion for you.
It was, but it was very fun. I had so much fun in that Commonwealth universe so far. I think because to me it feels pretty much like just one book, which was too big, so they had to chop it into two parts. And it is a bit of an up and down, and Pandora's Star is slightly better for me than Judas and Chain.
I think everyone says that.
But of course, I understand that the politics and the whole thing in Judas and Chain has to be there to get this big ending. And the big ending, the finale, is quite epic as well.
Yeah.
And it starts, it's going on for ages, and you think, now they're going there soon. and then no, it's more, and then it's more, and it's more. So that
it
is a bit,
it just keeps stepping up. Like this chase, there's a chase, and then, there's a battle. I mean, but the weapon that they use at the end is like, well, how are they going to defeat? Oh,
I mean, the reveal is really good, and it's worth just pushing through. Which sometimes is a bit at the end. We really have to push through. But it is, it's just a really, really good science fiction opera.
Space opera.
It is amazing. And just, yeah.
Okay,
I
so
really
what,
liked it.
Give us a star rating then. This is your star rating for both books. For each book then.
The first book was 5 stars.
Yeah.
And the second was 4. So it's in total of 4.
Oh, still, even all those complaints that you still think a 4-star book. For me, yeah. I think the first book
Let me check.
I mean, I'm just looking now of what I gave it on Goodreads. Like, I gave it 4 stars and the second one 3 stars. But I think both of those are, you know, with Goodreads, it's a bit difficult. So I'd probably just say, you know, for Pandora Star, like 4.5 stars, Judas and Jane, 3.5 stars. So I'd, you know, it would average out for 4 stars for me. But for you, it would average out for about 4.5 stars. So let's give Pandora Star and Judas and Jane. Shall we just give it a 4-star as a single unit, as a single story?
Yes.
4-star book?
4-star is good.
Okay. Okay. 4 stars. Anything else you want to say about it, or should we just wrap it up there? Would you continue on and read the Dreaming Void sequence?
Yes.
You would?
I would.
Okay. Are you going to? Should we do it?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to talk about the other bits.
Yeah, but
we've got a lot of stuff to get
through. But I think it's so difficult to recommend it to your listeners because I think pretty much everyone already read it.
No, it is a very popular book. I don't think everyone has read it, but like, yeah. I mean, let's just go back
here. I gave Judas and Chain 3 stars as well. That's right.
Yeah, okay. So let's say, together, like the first book is really, really good. Yeah. The second book is a good finish, but it's a step down
in
quality.
It's things.
Yeah, my review is 175 friends have reviewed it. So, what was it for Ready Player One? Like 290 people or something? I can't remember. So yes, yeah. But this is also a very popular book. Yes, a good example of good space opera science fiction from the 2000s.
Yes,
let me put it that way. Yes. Like it says. First published 2004, Pandora Scar. You know, it is of its time, but I think when we look back at, you know, this decade, we'll be like, okay, what's the, like, what I was saying before, was it talking to you about it with them? No, it's some other people. But like the Fire Upon the Deep by Verna Vinge, you'd be like, okay, that's a really good example of early 90s science fiction. You'll be like, okay, that's good. And here, I think this is a good thing. It's like of its time. It's talking about, you know, expansion and militarization and all these other kind of things, you know, and the, like the whole, you know, opening the box and war and, you know, there's lots of stuff that, you know, kind of
reflects.
This
is the whole thing that we still don't know if there's anything out there. And nope. And so this is one way that it could happen, that humans and alien species meet, and there's lots of possibilities there.
I'm just saying politically, I think it is reflecting that decade as well.
Yes, it does.
So let's wrap it up there. You can email me, luke@juggler.net. I do reply to every email I get. Better than that, though, you can also become my friend on Goodreads. I'm Luke Burridge. No, I don't actually... How do you even find me? You've searched me on there. Luke Burridge on there. You can also become Juliana's friend. You can find her. You'll be Juliana Kunzendorf. You'll be able to find it too. Also, join the SFBRP listener group. We're always chatting about different stuff there. There was a Hugulus thread that we're talking about at the moment. And what is it? Yeah, books I would like to see reviewed. That's a good place not just to convince me of a book I should review, but convince other people to also back you up in your book suggestion. Get on with that one. Follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurridge on Twitter. And I think that's about it. That's all I normally say here at this point. So thanks a lot for listening to our weird discussion of a book that I've not read for 10 years. Well, no, not 10 years, but for like 8 or 9 years ago. I read it long before the Science Fiction Book Review podcast, and that's been going since, you know, 7 years. No, how many years have I been doing this? Quite a few years.
250 something episodes.
2008 is when I started it. So we're coming up to, 6-7 years of seven complete years. 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Yeah, so 7 complete years. In December, it'll be 7 complete years of Science Fiction Book Review podcast.
Well done.
I probably read this book 8 or 9 years ago. So that's it for me. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.